I'm keep looking over there because of that table with everyone's photos on it. In many monasteries, that would be the place where you put the photo of someone who's died and you want to honor their memory. And I keep looking over and seeing myself and wearing the same shirt, actually. So it's like a little eerie, you know? And especially even last night when I walked in and there was Rodney's photo, because that position certainly would be, you know, that large photo under the sign. Rodney was the founding teacher of Seattle Insight. And so I walked in and I thought, oh, that's really like a little spooky, you know? Like, I think I'm having dinner with him this weekend. I don't think he's died, you know? But it's kind of nice being honored in that same way, you know? And it made me think, well, you know, how often we kind of wait in terms of gratitude or acknowledgement. We don't really need to. And it's probably wiser not to. But anyway, it's very funny for me to look over and see myself and I go, hi. You know? So welcome. This is really great to have this much time together. I hope we get a lot of practice together and certainly a lot of time for discussion as well. So equanimity, as I said last night, is an oft misunderstood concept. It can seem to us an awful lot like indifference or not caring or withdrawing from a situation or a person or life itself. Whereas really, in this context, it doesn't really mean that at all. It's a state of balance. That's probably the most literal translation. It's a state of balance, and it's balance that's very tied into wisdom, to insight, to seeing clearly. So as I sort of introduced last night, we're going to talk about it in terms of mindfulness practice and do some. We're going to talk about it in terms of loving kindness practice and do some. It has the same meaning, but slightly different variations. I also want to say, based on that wonderful introduction, thank you, that you know, I went to India to learn meditation in 1970. I was a junior in college. I went through this college program. I created an independent study project saying I wanted to go to India and learn meditation for my junior year. And they said, yes. So I said, great. And off I went. And the place I learned and my continued education in all these years has really been within a Buddhist context. So that's the languaging, that's the mode of expression, those are the stories, that's the psychology I tend to draw on. But the very first night of my first retreat, and I learned in a 10-day retreat, I walked into that monastery compound never having meditated before. And the first night, the teacher was S.N. Goenka, he said, the Buddha did not teach Buddhism, the Buddha taught a way of life. And so that's been like the foundation of my approach and my understanding ever since. As he went on to say, you know, we come together, we gather together. In no way, it's not about Buddhism, it's about ourselves. And so the idea is we look at a statue, say, of the Buddha, and it exemplifies a human being who had some very deep questions about life, like, what does it mean to be born an infant to this human body, to be so helpless and so at the mercy, so vulnerable to the actions of those around you, and then to grow up and to get older, to get sick, to die, whether you want that or not? And is there a kind of happiness we can have that isn't going to shatter, it isn't going to break as the body does its thing? And what does it mean to have a human mind in the ordinary sense, where it's just this cascade of changing emotions? Maybe we wake up happy, and then we get frightened, and then we get angry, and then we get sad, and then we get happy again, or we're full of faith, and we're full of doubt, and it's just this constantly changing, churning sea of states. And here, too, is there a way we can have a quality of happiness that isn't going to be distorted by these emotions, which may becoming or going. And it said that anything he discovered, the Buddha discovered, he discovered through the power of his own awareness, and so can we. Whatever our questions are, those deep, deep questions. Because when we say happiness, it doesn't mean something superficial. It doesn't mean just like enjoying yourself or having only pleasant things happen, because that's a fruitless wish, you know. But something deeper, more profound. How can we feel whole? How can we feel complete even when we're not getting what we want externally? Or how can we find a sense of integrity within? How can we find a sense, as I said, this night of belonging somewhere in this body, in this mind, with one another, with life, with this planet? That's kind of the meaning of happiness. And so whatever our own questions are, we cultivate awareness, we cultivate attention in order to come to some sense ourselves. So it's not about comparative religion. It's not about religion at all. It's really not about Buddhism. You know, I use that language because 1970 was a long time ago. And it's so nice when people introduce me and they say, she's been teaching a long time. Instead of like calculating the years, it's a lot of years. It's the most comfortable way of my expressing these things for me. But, depending on your orientation, it may not work for you. You may be doing a translation into another system or just kind of dynamic humanism or something. And that's fine. So please don't feel that that's what it's about. It's really not. So I'm actually going to start, also because of something that came up in my mind during the introduction, with asking you to do what is really my favorite reflection. I'm sure anybody amongst you who sat with me before has done this already with me, because it is my favorite. And that's just as we sit here together, you can close your eyes if you like, and just see who comes to mind in terms of someone who's played any role at all in your being here in this room right now. Somebody told you about their meditation practice, perhaps long ago. Maybe immediately someone's taking care of things at home so you can be here. Or maybe someone told you about this organization or read you a poem or challenged you in some way that really had you look deeper. So just see who comes to mind. Because nobody, I am sure, just saw a bunch of cars coming in this lot and thought, I'll go there too. We're all here because of conversations we had with people and relationships, interactions, encounters. The reason it came to mind, this reflection, and hearing the introduction, is because part of why I'm here, actually, is because of the Board of Regents of the state of New York, which gave away college scholarships to New York residents. That's how I was able to go to college, which is how I got to India, through this college program. So I'm really here because of those people. So just see who comes to mind. You know, we can feel so alone, but really this moment is a confluence of all these connections, as is every moment. That's the fabric of life each of us is a part of. So thank you. It's in that context that we'll do our own practice, actually. of this bigger picture. So how many of you would say you're new to meditation practice, or pretty new? Maybe you sat last night. Okay. So we're going to go through different practices that are going to build on one another. We're going to go through different forms of practice, some sitting, some walking. I should also say walking, the term walking is symbolic. If you have a physical issue with walking or you don't feel like walking or whatever, that's fine. It means activity. You know, that's the symbolic underlay. So rather than sitting with your eyes closed in a kind of inner state, it's walking or drinking a cup of tea, something with your eyes open, right? So that you're more engaged with the world around you as you are practicing mindfulness or loving kindness, something like that. So the actual schedule, so you don't have to think you're going to sit here for 8 hours, you know, unbrokenly. We're going to do sitting practice. We're going to have a discussion, of course, and things like that. But we're going to do sitting practice. We're going to do walking practice. And if you don't feel like walking, there are other things you can do. We're going to come back and do sitting. I don't know if these days, it's been a year since I was in Seattle, are generally done in silence or not so much? Or okay. Okay. Sure, we'll have periods of silence and some kind of like what I sometimes call a retreat within a retreat. We'll do like sitting, walking, sitting, all in silence. And this is, I was laughing because when I teach in London for the Insight group there, they rent a school, like a elementary school, I think, because it's the weekend and it's not being used. And the first year I was there, some brilliant person brought in like an espresso truck for the yard. And I didn't realize that, so I had people on silence and they were gesturing, trying to order their espresso or whatever, and it drove that poor person crazy. So during lunch, please feel free to talk, you know, like when you're ordering. I mean, there are ways in which you just have to use common sense. So we'll move in and out of silence in those ways. But it's really like an experiment, you know. It's like there's no pass-fail. In fact, you can't fail. You can't do it wrong. We're just experimenting with different styles of awareness, training awareness and attention, and seeing what our experience is. And whatever it is, it's fine. Because the cardinal rule, which I said last night, is that in terms of meditation practice, and certainly this system or this style of practice, what's arising in our experience is not that important. What's really important is how we're relating to what's arising in our experience. You know, how much presence, how much balance, how much awareness, how much kindness are we bringing forth in relationship to whatever it is that's come up. What comes up is always changing. Sometimes it's glorious and beautiful, and sometimes it's disquieting. I used to use this example a lot of meditation being like going into an old attic room. And it doesn't matter if the room has been dark for a day or a week or 10,000 years. We go into the room and we turn on the light. And so what we see is everything. We see these beautiful treasures. I mean, so beautiful, we can hardly believe they exist in our very own attic. And we see these dusty, neglected corners, and we think, ooh, I better clean that up. And maybe we see these objects that we're not that happy to see. I mean, I thought I got rid of that long ago. Why am I still freaked out over that? But it's there. We see everything a human being can want and know and feel, and that's fine. How we are with it is really the crucial question. That's in our hands. To have, you know, kind of tremendous dismay, even despair over what arises is a fruitless task. And it's a way of punishing ourselves, really, frankly. Because we can't control that. You can't say, I thought about it really carefully and I'll never be afraid again. You know, or I've grieved long enough, that's done now. Or I'll never fall asleep meditating again. That's not to say we can't affect conditions, right? We can. Maybe you don't eat an 18-course meal before you go to meditate. That would help. But you can't say never again because I have decided, right? Like I have control, because when conditions come together in a certain way, certain things arise. And rather than feeling so bad that we're not succeeding at being in control, which we never will be, we are empowered by how we are relating to what's come up. You know, we all know that, right? There's some thoughts that come up and we grab them and we take them to heart and we build a whole self-image on it. This is all that I'll ever feel. There are the thoughts that come up and we look at it and we think, oh, that's weird, you know, and we let it go. And it's like, no big deal, same thought. But how we're relating to it is everything. As one of my teachers once said, it's not the thought that's the problem, it's the glue. You know, we grab it and we hold it and we believe it. We believe it's the only thing that, you know, is true. All the ways that we add on to something. And we don't have to do that, and that's tremendously empowering. So how we relate is really the key. And that is something very much in our hands. And I say that as somebody who I feel like, you know how sometimes you feel like you're learning the same thing again and again and again and again, hopefully at a different level. So I think that's one of my things, because I can look back over years of being with different teachers, and this teacher said that to that end, you know, and this teacher said that same end, and then, you know, I can sort of look back and think, God, I kept learning that again and again and again and again. I remember sitting once at IMS, so it was after 76 when we moved in, and we brought one of our teachers, this man named Manindra, up from the U.S., from the India to be in the U.S. to teach. So he was teaching, I was sitting, and I was very distressed about something that had come up in my mind. I don't even know what it was at this point. And I'm sure he could hear it in my tone of voice as I was describing my experience. And he said something to me like, why are you so upset about this thought that has come up in your mind? Did you invite it? Did you say at like 12:15, I'd like to be filled with self-hatred, please? No. When conditions come together for something to arise, it will arise. How are we with it is the point. You know, so I say all that to hopefully relieve you of some of the sense of pass fail, you know, or I'm having the wrong experience, or no one else in this room is thinking, it's only me, or, you know, all those things will usually arise, but we don't have to believe them. Because it's irrelevant in a way. What's most crucial is how we are with what's going on, and that's the place of our work, so it's kind of exciting, you know, because that's real. That's something that is present and possible for us, no matter what's going on. So I'm going to say a little bit more than we're going to sit, and we'll just take it from there. Out of the Buddhist psychology, and this has to do with mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness, but this is equanimity in the context of mindfulness to begin with. The Buddha described our knowing of the universe, of the world, saying that in any moment we know the world in one of six ways. That's the five senses of seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling. And then what he called the sixth sense, which isn't something paranormal, but it's knowing through the mind. Emotion, thought, cognition, imagery. So in every moment, we know the world in one of six ways. Seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, or through the mind. And we perceive every moment as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's kind of part of the bundle. We see a sight and it registers within us as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. We hear a sound and it has that kind of feeling tone that comes along with it. That feeling tone is not considered inherent to the object, you know, and we know that. Like somebody could say something and we've had like no sleep and we're really irritated and we just got a thing that our plane is late, you know, and they say, make some comment and we just find it so unpleasant. Another day, we've had a great night's sleep, we're not going on an airplane, and somebody makes the same comment, it's fine, it's funny. You know, it's kind of cute. You know, so that feeling tone is not inherent in the object always, you know, like forevermore. And sometimes we do work on interpretation, assumption, you know, why are we, generally speaking, finding that so unpleasant, so scary, whatever it is. But the bulk of the work of mindfulness, the way it functions, is a little later in the sequence. We register something as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's so fast. And then the question is, how are we reacting to that? There are many ways in which we can have a very funny relationship to pleasure. I started talking about this a little bit last night. Everything from, as soon as we start enjoying something, we grab it. We're so afraid it's going to change or move that we try to fix it. We try to freeze it, which never works. So it's actually a very fear-based reaction. We don't feel we deserve it. There's too much suffering in the world or people close to us or too much pain or we just don't feel we deserve anything. And so this joy, this delight, this sense of wonder starts to rise and we reject it. And many of you have probably heard me tell the story of my going to Maui, yes? No, good, someone hasn't. So Ram Dass, who is someone I met in India at my very first meditation retreat in January of 1971, lives on Maui and he had, you know, as many of you know, a very severe stroke almost 20 years ago now, or maybe 20 years ago. And these days he doesn't leave Maui, so he does teach, however, and co-teaches. So every year, especially in December, or really twice a year now, there's like a big retreat. And organizers kind of take over this resort, which is like right on the beach, and he moves there for the course of the retreat, and we teach. So the first year that I went there in December, so first of all, I'm from New England, so December, right? It's icy, it's cold, it's miserable, and I'm on Maui. And so it was public, because it's like a retreat, you know, so it was on my schedule, but I did something extra when I got there. Like I tweeted about it or something. And right away I started getting these responses from people like, wow, you're on Maui. And Maui is like, it's like unearthly beauty. You know, it's like you can't even believe you're on this planet. It's so beautiful. And there we were in this resort and like old friends and loved ones. But I started getting these responses like, wow. And I found myself writing back right away saying, it's very humid here. It's terribly humid. And I realized, that's weird, actually, you know, like, enjoy the fact you're on Maui. But instead of like, oh no, it's not really as good as you think. So I brought it up in the hall in the context of some talk, and it became like a theme of the retreat. I was walking out of the hall one day, and these two people behind me, a friend and the now adult son of another friend, were talking, and he was saying to her, oh, my mom was really, she was so close to coming, and the last minute she decided she couldn't come, and she feels so terrible, and She really blames herself for not showing up here. And I heard my friend say, did you tell her how humid it is here? You know? And I did tell that story a lot, because then the next year I landed in Maui, and then I tweeted, you know, just landed on Maui, and all these people wrote and said, is it very humid, you know? And people, wherever I go, somebody brings up the humidity in Maui. So I'm going again in early December. We'll see how it is. You know, we can have a very distorted relationship to pleasure. I mean, evolutionary biologists say we have a negativity bias. We're wired to look for danger, to look for threat. It takes a kind of intentionality to open to the goodness, the joy, the bounty, the wonder that is also coming our way. So that's a very big question. How do I tend to relate to pleasure? And needless to say, probably we have can have a very distorted relationship to pain. We have physical pain, emotional pain, whatever it is. We have a lot of personal conditioning. We have a lot of cultural conditioning, usually. I'd say my feeling is that in America, for one thing, in terms of mainstream culture, there tends to be a big emphasis on being in control always. And if you're hurting, if you're afraid, if you're sick, even if you're dying, it can feel like a personal humiliation. You've lost control. You failed in some way. With our own pain and difficulty, if you have that conditioning, you tend to want to hide it. It's something shameful. Someone else's pain is really an affront. Like, we want to hide them, you know? Like, just go away. I'm having a bad day because of you. I have a... I guess you'd call her a student, someone who'd come to see me once, about 6 months after like a terrible, terrible tragedy in her life. And what she said to me was, first of all, she said, my friends are getting a little impatient with me. It's like 6 months is long enough, you know, get over it. And believe me, it was not a 6 month thing. And then she said, my friends all have golden lives. Nothing ever goes wrong. Which I didn't believe for a moment. My friends all have golden lives. Nothing ever goes wrong. So now I exist as a symbol of life gone awry, and I make them very uncomfortable. So then I had one of those experiences, you know, where you just see these words come out of your mouth. So what I heard come out of my mouth was, I think you need new friends. And then I said, you should meet my friends. They're all a wreck, you know? You know, which is not exactly true, you know? But there is a kind of honesty we can have when we think, you know what? Things can be really tough. I don't feel that great or whatever. You know, minus the pretense that is put upon us by outside forces. What is my actual experience? Sometimes it's painful. That doesn't mean we have to get what I called last night extra suffering, which we do by, you know, bitterness or isolation or the kinds of things we might add on to that painful state, but some things really hurt. That's what I want in my epitaph, by the way. Some things just hurt. And it's not because you have the wrong attitude, and it's not because you're not thinking properly, or it's not because of your resistance either. Something's just hurt. The extra suffering is something else. That may well be because of our resistance and our shame or whatever it is we're adding to what's going on, but something's just hurt. So we can have really weird conditioning and painful, painful conditioning around painful experience. And then the Buddha even talked about neutral experience, those in between times, not very pleasant, not very unpleasant, just kind of, all right, you know, it's another breath. Until you can't breathe. And, things that are routine, things that are repetitive, things that are ordinary, those are the times where we tend to go to sleep. We kind of wait. We go into abeyance. We can be awfully dependent on intensity to feel alive. And most of us, our attention is not awfully trained to subtlety, to feel that connected to something that's just kind of neutral, to feel the nuance of it, to see into it. So this is our ordinary conditioning. We experience the world every moment in one of six ways. We feel it to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. We can have this kind of automatic reaction, or that's the moment of mindfulness. That's sort of the most potent area or arena for mindfulness. Having felt something to be pleasant, how are we with it? Having felt something to be painful or unpleasant, how are we with it? And even with neutral experience, can we wake up and actually connect instead of waiting for something else to happen? So sometimes mindfulness is defined as the quality of awareness where we are not adding, grasping or holding on, aversion, anger or fear, or delusion, which is that kind of numbing or spacing out. We've already felt the pleasure, the pain, or the neutrality. And sometimes people think in projection, like if I get really good at meditation, that's going to like even out. It's just going to be this gray blur in my life. You know, no highs, but that's okay because no lows. It's just sort of and sometimes that's what we think equanimity is. And as I said last night, some people long for that state. Some people dread it, but it's not what happens anyway in meditation, you know. We feel whatever, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, constantly changing. But we don't need to be compelled into those old ways of relating. We can have presence, that's mindfulness. We can have balance, that's mindfulness and equanimity. We can have a kind of compassion or compassionate interest. We take an interest in our experience instead of feeling it's fallen upon us, you know, and is alien from us. There are many ways in which we shift how we experience what is going on, how we relate to it. And that's really where mindfulness is alive. And that non-reactive quality is the equanimity part. Equanimity means balance. And in this case, it's the balance that leads to wisdom. It doesn't mean you don't feel anything. It doesn't mean you never take action, as I talked about last night. But we don't necessarily want to be driven by these old, very conditioned ways of relating. For one thing, we can't really see more clearly when we're in that sort of reactive mode. So if we have an emotion, for example, that comes up and we either thought we got rid of it long ago or we don't really want to allow ourselves to feel it, it's not that easy to look into it, to become more aware of maybe layers of other emotions that are in there with it or watch how much it changes. Whatever we look at, if we look at clearly enough and kind of cleanly enough, we'll come to see the changing nature of it. So I was just talking to somebody here about pain. That's one example. I have a friend with a very severe chronic pain, physical pain condition, and she worked in just that way. And what she came back to me and said was, I found this space within the pain. Not that the pain disappeared, but within it, she could see it was an alive system. It wasn't a solid monolithic block. It was a moment of pressure, a moment of burning, a moment of this, a moment of that. None of that sounds good and none of that feels good, but that's an alive system. That means it's always changing. And perceiving it in that way, she found the space within the pain, something like that. So it's very powerful to actually be able to be with our experience in a different way. We're not superimposing different ideas like I'm going to see change within 15 minutes or something like that. It's just what happens because of the quality of our attention. And we can see so much more deeply. So I'm going to send you on a short break so you get a chance to just stretch. And then we'll come back and we'll do a sitting to begin with just to get more concentrated, you know, around the breath and then a little later this morning, open up to more experiences as they come and go. Okay, so why don't we take a break? Be happy. You can talk if you want. This isn't one of those silent ones. Okay, so kind of foundational exercise in meditation of any school usually is choosing an object of awareness, which could be anything, resting your attention on that object, and when you find your attention has wandered, bringing it back. And when I say foundational exercise, I think we tend to think in very linear terms, like, oh, that's 101, I did it, now I'm beyond it. But it's not like that. It's something we keep coming back to. It's really the stabilizing of our attention, the deepening of concentration. That's the platform for later expanding our awareness to all kinds of different objects. And then we always kind of come back, you know, within the same session or even now and then. We say, you know what, I feel scattered particularly, or I feel fragmented in some way. I think I'm just going to focus on this process of concentration. So we choose an object of awareness. Different schools have different objects. It could be a mantra, it could be a sound, it could be an image, it could be a prayer, it could be something happening in your body, it could be loving kindness, which we'll do later. Very commonly, even if you have another object that you're focusing on largely, very commonly, at least some part of one's practice is resting your attention on the feeling of the breath. Because of a couple of reasons, as my early teachers would say, you don't have to believe anything in order to feel your breath. You don't have to call yourself a Buddhist or a Hindu or reject anything else. If you're breathing, you can be meditating. And one teacher went on to say, I've always felt very charmingly, he said, the breath is very portable. You know, so let's say you practice at home 10 minutes a day, and you're using the breath as that place to return, the way to come back to the moment, come back to yourself, then you're at work, or you're commuting, and the scene around you is very pressured, it's very intense, and you start getting anxious. You don't have to, like, at work, try to open up a closet door and pull out all this equipment, sit down cross-legged and look weird. You know, you're breathing. Nobody even has to know you're doing it. It's a completely private resource, a way to ground, a way to get present. And we're used to it, right? Because we've done it over and over again in the formal practice. So now we're in a much faster, more pressured, more intense, more stressful environment, you've got it, right? You can do that. So in this exercise, I'm going to suggest we use the breath. And in this school, in this system, it's just the normal, natural breath. Different yogic systems, you know, you're breathing very intentionally through one nostril or at a certain depth or whatever. So this is not that. Just breathing naturally, however the breath is appearing. And we find the place where the breath is strongest for us. Or just choose a place. The nostrils, the chest, or the abdomen. Bring your attention there and just rest. I did this one book called Our Real Happiness, which has a lot of guided meditations in it. And the first time it came back from the editor, she added a note saying, "You're using the word rest an awful lot. Are you very tired?" So I wrote back and I said, "I am pretty tired, but that's the word." You know, and as I said again last night, sometimes people think with the breath, if I get like a stranglehold on the breath, my mind won't wander. It'll actually wander more. The image, they say, from the Buddha is rest your attention lightly, the way a butterfly would rest upon a flower. That's how we rest our attention on the feeling of the breath. You may get an image of the breath. You may hear the breath. But what we're paying attention to is the feeling of the breath. If you're with the breath at the nostrils, it may be tingling, vibration, warmth, coolness. If you're with the chest or the abdomen, it may be movement, pressure, stretching, release. You're not trying to name those things, but that's what we're feeling. That's what we're paying attention to, right? We rest our attention on the feeling of the breath. Sooner or later, usually sooner, our attention wanders. And we kind of wake up in the middle of thinking about Monday's flight or the weather in New York or our trip to India in 10 years or our trip to India 10 years ago or whatever it is, or we've fallen asleep and we wake up after a nice snooze. There's this moment of emerging that is really considered the critical moment. Instead of judging yourself or feeling bad about however much time has gone by, it's a moment of opportunity where we can practice letting go of whatever's taken us away. One of my teachers call that exercising the letting go muscle. We practice letting go and we practice beginning again, which means with some kindness towards yourself, you bring your attention back to the feeling of the breath. You don't have to go through a litany of your failure and, you know, how you're so much worse than everyone in the room. We let go and we come back. Maybe 10 seconds later, you have to let go and come back again, and that's considered fine. That's actually the training, right? So it's a process of recovery, process of learning how to start over and over again. That's what we're really doing. So see if you can sit comfortably. Have your back be straight without being strained or overarched. You want some energy in your body, but not like so much energy you're really stiff and uptight. You also want to be just relaxed and at ease. But not like so relaxed that your waist slumped over. So you feel your way into what feels like a balanced posture for you. And close your eyes or not, however you feel most comfortable. If your eyes are closed and you start to get really sleepy, it's good to open your eyes and continue on that way. And even before we get to the breath, often we start by listening to sound, whether it's the sound of my voice or other sounds. It's a way of relaxing deep inside, allowing our experience to come and go. It's like the sounds just wash through you. Bring your attention to the feeling of your body sitting, whatever sensations you discover. Bring your attention to your hands. And see if you can make the shift from the more conceptual level, like of fingers, to the world of direct sensation. picking up pulsing, throbbing, pressure, whatever it might be. Again, you don't have to name these things, but feel them. And you can bring your attention to the feeling of the breath, just the normal, natural breath. See if you can feel one breath. Without concern for it's sort of gone by, without leaning forward for even the very next breath, just this one. If you like, you can use a quiet mental notation like in, out, or rising, falling to help support the awareness of the breath, but very quiet. So your attention's really going to feeling the breath, one breath at a time. And if you find your attention wandering, you've gotten lost in thought, spun out in a fantasy, or you fall asleep, truly don't worry about it. We say the most important moment is the next moment, after you've been gone, after you've gone to sleep or whatever. It's that moment of emergence that's most important, where we practice letting go and we practice beginning again. And if you have to do that a few billion times in the next few minutes, it's totally fine. That was nice, wasn't it? However it was nice. Even if it was riotous, it was nice. So I'm wondering if you have any questions or comments. I'd also like to hear from you. If you have a particular interpretation or reaction to either the word equanimity or the word balance. Last night I talked about my reactions to both. And I'll need you, we don't have a microphone to send out to you, so I'll need you to try to speak up. I'll try to repeat it if it's not very long. Yes?
Hey, Jen.
Hi.
Can you talk about equanimity in relation to anger?
Okay, equanimity in relation to anger. I think it's got, there are different levels to that or different layers to that. I think we want enough equanimity around what we're feeling, which means we're not adding to it, so that we're not compelled into action. You know, I used the example last night of a 9 or 10 year old boy who defined mindfulness as not hitting someone in the mouth. You know, that didn't mean he didn't feel anger. It meant that he could relate to his anger in such a way that he wasn't sort of driven into the same old action, which had gotten him into a lot of trouble before. So it's not that we never act, but there's like a pause or there's a space between what we're feeling and how we act. And that's why mindfulness or equanimity is not really considered passive, but it could be like creative. And the idea around equanimity is not that we don't feel things, but we don't, it's the same as mindfulness. There are two extremes that mindfulness avoids. One extreme is disliking what we're feeling and pushing against it and being ashamed of it or afraid of it and trying to hide it. And then we just get tighter and tighter and tighter. So that doesn't really work. The other extreme is to fall completely into what we're feeling, just to be overwhelmed by it and defined by it. And then we're lost because we lose perspective. We lose understanding. What we feel is feeling like the only thing we'll ever feel. It's defining reality. You know, it's pretty tight. And so we say mindfulness slices right down the middle. So I'll give you another example. It's not precisely anger, but it kind of is anger. One thing I say in my most recent book, Real Love, is that if you have a very persistent critical voice, like an inner critic, that's not saying helpful things, you know, but is really just kind of nagging or putting you down and things like that, one of the suggestions is to give it a name. Maybe give it a wardrobe, give it a persona. Because everything depends on how we relate to what's going on, right? So I go on to say, with apologies to anyone in the room who's named Lucy, I named my inner critic Lucy after the character in the Peanuts comic strip. And that was because a friend of ours once rented a house for several of us do a retreat in. And when I went into the room that was going to be my bedroom, I saw someone had left a cartoon on the desk from the Peanuts comic strip. And in the first frame, Lucy is talking to Charlie Brown and says, "Oh, you know, Charlie Brown, what your problem is, the problem with you is that you're you." And the second frame, poor Charlie Brown says, "Well, what in the world can I do about that?" And then in the third and final frame, Lucy says, "I don't pretend to be able to give advice. I merely point out the problem." And somehow when I was doing walking meditation by that desk, my eye would keep falling on the line, "The problem with you is that you're you." Because that Lucy voice had been so dominant in my earlier life. But I also saw the skills that meditation had given me. In fact, it happened pretty quickly after I saw the cartoon. Something great happened for me. And my very first thought was, "It's never going to happen again." And I greeted that thought with, "Hi, Lucy." And my favorite form of that was, "Chill out, Lucy. Just chill out." Now, that's different than, "You're right, Lucy. You're always right," which is being overtaken by that voice. It's also different than, "I'm so embarrassed, I can't believe Lucy is still here. I've been meditating all these years, why is Lucy still here? And I spent all that money in therapy just last year, and Lucy's still here, and I'm such a terrible failure," you know? It's, again, it's like mindfulness slices right down the middle. So we're very aware of and connected to what's happening, but we're not like getting overcome by it. We're also not pushing it away. It's like, "Oh, this is what's happening." Like, "Hi, Lucy." there's tenderness there even, and compassion and presence. And it's like knowing your awareness is stronger than Lucy, right? That Lucy voice. So in an extreme oversimplification of this Tibetan Buddhist technique, they would say, invite Lucy to dinner. Don't let her have the run of the house, because that would be dangerous, but you don't have to be so freaked out. You don't have to be so ashamed. You don't have to be so upset about Lucy. Just invite her to dinner. You can be nice, you know. Let her sit there and have a meal. So someone in the room didn't like it when I said that, and so I said, how about a cup of tea? And they said, how about a cup of tea to go? You know, so I said, okay, if that's the extent of your hospitality. But you see what I mean, right? It's that place in the middle. So that's how we are with anger. That's how we are with the different things that arise. You're not trying to dismiss it or make it go away, or you're not freaked out because it's there, hopefully. But you're also not just spinning in it, you know, and being overcome by it, because then there's no learning, right? We're just in some old pattern. So if you can say, oh, there's anger, you know, and be observing it, what do you see? Maybe you see layers of sadness or layers of fear. You have a very different sense of the kind of overall picture of anger, you know, rather than just the one emotion. You see it's constantly changing. It's moving. It arrives with such a bang. It feels like it's all we'll ever feel, but really, is it? Look at it even within itself. It's always moving and changing. You might see that it's very painful. You know, so instead of calling it bad or wrong, you experience compassion for yourself in the face of the pain of it. You might feel the positive part of it, which is the energy. You know, and also notice the more detrimental aspects of it. I talked some about this last night as well. You know, like, if you, like right now, bring up the last time, I don't know how long ago it might have been, that you were really angry at yourself, just like bring it back. And just take a look at it. It's like you're watching the anger movie. It's kind of interesting, you know, it's not a time where any of us thinks, I said that stupid thing in the morning, but I did 5 great things the same morning. Those 5 great things, they're gone. You know, being socked into a state like that will give us tunnel vision. It's like when you're really afraid. It's not a time you think, you know, if it doesn't work out this way, maybe it'll work out that way. It's not going to work out. You know, so we see all those different aspects, the positive part, the energy. We see the narrowing of perception, the way it gives us tunnel vision. We have a very different understanding about anger after all that than maybe we did at the beginning. It's not bad. It's not wrong. It's also not necessarily a path toward greater happiness. You know, we just really take a look. And that's why mindfulness is considered the engine for insight. What we're trying to do is understand ourselves and understand, you know, way beyond the conditioning we all have about what will make us happy and what will make us strong and what will make us weak and make us kind of stupid, is really seeing for ourselves. And so we set up the environment where there can be maximum seeing. Maximum clear seeing, which means letting go of the things that come up that are old habits, things like that. That's the equanimity. It's not in wiping out the feeling, but it's in what is the environment that gets created. But it can't be callousness, you know. There's an element in equanimity that's very connected to the experience. Otherwise, it's just, I don't know, looking the other way or something like that, which it really can't be. It has to be a different kind of balance. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Trying to incorporate some of that into my practices. So I understand where equanimity is good for dealing with
The comment was about reading James Barrett's book, Awakening Joy, and how equanimity feels kind of like a downer compared to awakening joy. It makes sense with more painful or negative emotions. But what about, like, the positive emotions? Well, here, too, I think there's a way in which we can experience some delightful state, but relate to it in such a way that we're adding fear to it. You know, what if it goes away? Well, we'll go away, you know, so that's the truth. Or what if it, you know, is not as joyful as her joy? Or what if, you know, I mean, we do all kinds of things just by force of habit, and it doesn't actually enhance the state. It inhibits the state. Equanimity doesn't mean we don't feel anything. It means we're not reacting in the same way. Equanimity has a lot to do with wisdom. Usually we say in mindfulness it's the balance that leads to wisdom, because we get to look, you know, instead of being caught up in all these old patterns. We get to see, oh, look at how changeable that is, or look at how connected we all are, whatever it is. In loving kindness, we say, but I think it would work actually in your description too, equanimity is the balance that's born of wisdom. So you want to experience that joy more completely, not less completely, and notice the moment you start to cling to it, it doesn't feel that joyful. When I was first practicing in India, everything was painful, but I hit a certain place where for a time all my experience was just delightful. You know, I'd sit and I'd feel all serene and peaceful and with these nice tingly sensations in my body, and right away I would start thinking, isn't it going to be great feeling exactly like this for the rest of my life? And then, you know, I'd get bored, or my knee would start hurting, or my back would start hurting, and I'd always blame myself, like, what did you do wrong that made this go away? You know, did you sit too straight? Were you breathing wrong? Like, but it wasn't that I'd done something wrong that made it go away. It went away because everything goes away. And that's a deeper joy than just the state of delight, you know, to be able to relate with wisdom and understanding and not blame yourself unfairly and not freak out and not try to cling to what you can't keep and all of that. So wisdom doesn't hurt, really. It's its own kind of happiness, and the balance that comes with that is really important. There are also practices that are, they're not so much about seeing clearly what is and that kind of joy. They're about cultivation or intentionality. Loving kindness is a little bit like that, so we'll talk about that later. But, you know, we do the practice to create a kind of balance in a bigger sense from our ordinary habits. So gratitude practice is a good example of that. If we are hardwired, as evolutionary biologists would say, towards seeing threat and danger with a negativity bias, it takes some intentionality to reflect on the good in our lives. You know, we are as though still in the jungle getting ready to be eaten by a tiger or something like that, you know. So we hear a noise and say, yeah, right? But especially if you're a New Yorker and you don't like the jungle that much. It's like scary. That doesn't mean it takes force or coercion or being conflict avoidant or trying to push away the painful. It takes intentionality. So I'd say, you know, a very common thing we hear these days is that one of the most healing things any of us could do is keep a gratitude journal that is write down three things each night that we're grateful for from the day. And I always say, you know, it can be that you're breathing. It doesn't have to be like grandiose or magnificent. And I always say, as is true, that doesn't come naturally to me. I am so much more conditioned to come to the end of the day and think about what I can complain about. You know, I didn't show up in the way I wanted to. That other person disappointed me. There's always an airline. There's always a phone service. You know, that's where my mind will go. And so that's what I mean by intentionality. I have to say, okay, now let's include this aspect of life, which we so rarely include. So you realize that it's very easy for me to make the list of what to complain about. That could be a long list. But three things I have to be grateful for, I have to say, okay, now it's gratitude time. Let's take a look. So that's not phony and it's not hypocritical. It's trying to give some airtime to what's true, but gets almost no airtime just in the ordinary course of events. So there are a lot of practices like that. That are really good. They're both life practices and kind of platform practices for insight. You know, because if you're incredibly judgmental and you feel you don't have enough and you're not enough and you have no capacity or wherewithal inside, and then you're looking at something very painful, it's not going to work. You know, it's going to be too painful. We need to be able to meet what's going on, if it's painful, emotionally, physically, with some resource, some sense of, or stressful. I mean, so that's the stress equation, right? It's not just what's coming at us, but what's the level of resource we have to meet it. So there are many practices where we're just building that sense of resource. It's why, you know, if you look at, within the Buddhist teaching, you look at a path. They say the Buddha always started by speaking about generosity because it'll lift our spirits and make us happier. And then we use that happiness as a resource for moving on. So, and the way it's put is we all have something to give. If you have no money, you can thank somebody. You know, you could smile at them. You could listen to somebody. That's an act of generosity. And that moves on to morality. You know, if you have a very complicated life and deceitful and lots of secrets, and it's not going to be that easy to sit down and meditate seeking the truth, because we tend to be haunted in ways that are surprising. Like, oh, you know, that's kind of complicated, and what if they find out? And you know, so the invitation is like for once in our lives to try to do something the easiest way possible rather than the hardest way possible and sort of take a look at how we speak to one another and, you know, how truthful we are and what we've got sort of lurking in some way that is kind of guilt-inducing or whatever, and clean it up. And then we move from there to loving kindness, and then we move from there to looking at just anything, including the more difficult things that may come up. You know, so we're not just kind of going in cold, but we're building the resource all along the way. If you feel you have nothing inside and you're trying to meet something very difficult, it's very hard. You know, it's overwhelming. We're exhausted. We just don't feel we have it in us. It's like life, you know. You're tired and you're burnt out and you're kind of sick of it. And then somebody comes and starts telling you their very sad story and you're just thinking, go away. You know, I can't handle it because we don't have it in that moment, which is very different than when we feel a sense of being buoyed up or held up or not being so alone, or we've got some sense of inner abundance and somebody comes and tells us that story and we're there. You know, it's kind of inevitable. So it's like that. There are lots of practices where we cultivate the good in a way and keep working with that. Yes, somebody behind. Okay, so the comment was about anxiety and fear and how there can be a common conditioning, like, don't ever feel it, you know, just override it, stay busy, something like that. And that's very true. There's also, you know, sometimes our conditioning is so strong about many things, anxiety, loneliness, boredom, that we will do anything to not feel them, and really we would be better off if we just sat there and felt it, rather than get driven into the behavior that we're using to not feel it. But it's also true that there's a skill to that, you know, because the purpose of being with a painful experience is not to suffer, but to develop a different relationship to that painful experience. And so that implies some energy and some interest. It usually implies kind of a balance in our approach that, just as an example, this is an example about physical pain, but we use physical pain as the template for all kinds of painful experiences like anxiety. Well, the first thing I should say about emotional pain and patterns like that is that we don't call them bad or wrong, we call them painful, which is what they are. And so that's a switch for most people, right? It's like I'm trying to school myself not to say I have a bad knee. I mean, it's really not bad, you know? It's not like misbehaving and needing to be punished. It hurts, you know? That's different. And so that's one switch we have toward compassion. But when we are paying attention, say, to physical pain, usually it's wise to be with it and then leave it, be with something easier, and then go back to it. And that's just the skill that one learns in being with it, if you can leave it for something that's easier. So I kind of learned that in an emphatic way when in 1984, when we brought this Burmese teacher named Sayadaw Upandita to Barrie, to the Insight Meditation Society, to teach a 3-month retreat that we were going to sit, you know, Joseph and I, and for some months Jack, we're going to sit under his guidance and you know, and our friends at the retreat center. So we had never met him before, but we heard he was a really great teacher, and he was a really great teacher. So we brought him. We invited him, and then he showed up one day, and we started sitting the next, so that was intense. And he also turned out to be an extremely demanding, fierce, intense teacher. I mean, really fierce. I said last night that my teachers never said to me, there's such a thing as trying too hard. I once overheard him say that to somebody. I almost fell down the stairs. You know, he never said that to me, and he didn't generally say that. He was really fierce, and we had a great relationship. It, like, worked for me, but every once in a while, I'd look at him and think, what did we do? You know, and so one day, we were in the meditation hall, and he was doing a question and answer session, and someone asked him just that. How long should I pay attention to physical pain before I move my attention to something that's easier, listening to sound, or being somewhere in your body that was not in pain? You know, the loving kindness are different options. And I thought, given his personality, he was going to say you should be with the pain till you fall over. Really, I did. And to my astonishment, he said, don't be with the pain for very long. And remember, physical pain is also a template for emotional pain, disappointment, things like that. He said, don't be with it for very long. Be with it, move your attention to something that's easier. Maybe go back to it, move your attention to something that's easier. He said, it's not wrong to just, like, be with the pain and be with the pain and be with the pain, but you'll likely get exhausted. So it's better to build in balance all along the way, because the point is not to sit there, you know, gritting your teeth and hating it and fearing it and sweating and crying. The point is to take an interest in it. Be kinder to yourself in the face of it, things like that. Develop a different relationship to it. So he said, don't be with it for very long. And I was sitting there thinking, Boy, if those words are coming out of his mouth, it must really be true. Because he was the furthest thing in the universe from somebody who'd say something just to be nice. It was unthinkable. And that's an interesting thing to ponder, right? And I have found, honestly, we'll get into this again when we do loving kindness for a difficult person, which is kind of a similar instruction. Don't start with the most unthinkable person on earth. Start with someone you have a little bit of conflict with. I found this a very unpopular instruction, both in terms of pain and in terms of difficult people. There's often something in us that feels it doesn't count, till we're like right at the extreme edge. But it counts because it's like strength training. You know, we're building up that capacity all along the way. And that's very important. So it's like that. You feel the anxiety. You feel everything calling you away from the anxiety. You remind yourself it's just for a moment. Just be with it in that moment. Feel it as it is. Take an interest in it. Leave it. Then go back. Something like that. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The comment was about a passage, a chapter, and it was actually my first book, Loving Kindness, and it was about equanimity, where I talked about going to see one of my teachers was this woman named Deepa Ma who lived in Calcutta. And this was a trip Joseph and I were doing around the world. We were going to Sweden and then we were going to Australia. So we took the opportunity to go to Calcutta to see her in between. So that brought us to Calcutta in monsoon season, where I had not been before. And she lived in, not as poor as it gets, but, you know, pretty, from our standards, it would be a pretty poor neighborhood. And up on the fourth floor of this building and just a room, and there was like a common kitchen, a common bathroom for everyone on the floor. And she was just a brilliant, amazing person. And her room, her little room was like filled with light, you know. So we spent the afternoon with her and just, you know, it was a really like blessed occasion. And then we didn't really think, oh, it's been raining the whole time we're sitting here. And it turned out that in that part of Calcutta, at least then, when it rains like that and it's monsoon season, the sewers overflow. So we walked outside and Joseph and I, and Joseph's like 6'3" and a half or something, and the sewers had overflown. So there was all this waste, you know, several feet high on the streets, on the sidewalk, and there was like this step down from the sidewalks, and Joseph said, oh, this should be interesting. And I thought, yeah, if you're 6'3" and a half, it's interesting, you know, but it's not that interesting for me, you know. And, I mean, it was absolutely disgusting. I mean, it was in every way, you know. And cars couldn't drive. I mean, it was just awful. And we finally got to the hotel we were staying in, and within a couple of days, we had flown on to Australia. And somebody took us to the Sydney Opera House, which is like this architectural marvel, you know, right on the water. And it was this amazing symphony. And everyone was dressed really nicely and smelled really good. You know, and so I was sitting there thinking, oh, what happened to Calcutta? You know, like, which was just 2 days before, something like that. So that's the story in the book about equanimity, that life circumstance can change. Doesn't take 2 days sometimes, you know. And depending on your mind, it can take 2 minutes. Just like that, pleasure and pain and everything in between, and sometimes extreme. And so it was a chapter about equanimity. And you could depending on your experience by the end of retreats and then leaving, you know, you could certainly relate it to that. But there's something about the flexibility and understanding that with any circumstance, you know, one of the first things we look at is what might I be adding on to this? If it's pleasant, maybe we don't feel we deserve it. Maybe we're actually shunning it. You know, maybe we're pushing it away. Or we're clinging. I must only feel this forevermore. Or if it's painful, you know, look at all the many things we might add on to it. It's only me, the sense of isolation. This is forever. Whatever it might be. And so all those add-ons are kind of distortions, and they don't help. So that's the first thing we look at, and seeing if we can relinquish some of that. And then it's kind of a quality of interest and almost amusement at where our minds can go, and realizing that, you know, you don't have to blame yourself for what you're feeling or thinking, but how are you acting? You know, that we do have a responsibility for. And looking at causes and conditions, you know, coming into a retreat is often like culture shock if you haven't done it before. And I've had huge long discussions, for example, with people in places where they really strictly want people to take off their shoes. And people freak out, you know. And if you're used to doing it for 50 years, it's like nothing, right? But if you're not used to doing it, it's kind of odd. And it's just one of many things. What do you mean we're going to be silent? What do you mean I'm going to eat and no one's going to talk to me? You know, I tell the story about a parents' course we did, as we called it, early on at the history of IMS, where our friends came to us and said, our parents are very freaked out about this strange new horrible hobby we have of meditating. Why don't you do a retreat for all of them? And this was a long time ago. So, you know, it was like, so we did. We thought, oh, that's a good idea. Let's gather all these frightened, hostile people together and do a retreat for them, you know. And it's like, usually our retreats are silent, certainly silent meals, and we knew it could never happen there. We just couldn't, you know, we couldn't ask them to do that. But, it, you know, it's like we kept having to make people go outside to smoke, you know. It was like, it was a long time ago. And it was kind of an amazing experience by the end, but it was huge culture shock for them coming in. And, you know, people would bring, like, in those days we had no locks on the doors, the bedroom doors, and people, you know, would bring like everything they brought with them into the meditation hall, because they couldn't imagine a world where they'd be safe and their possessions would be safe. You know, it's culture shock coming in, and it's culture shock leaving. Where, I mean, this is a little different because there's some talking and because you know, we're not being fed and we're not having kind of decisions made for us, which is usually the case. If you do an intensive retreat, you're not doing the meal plan, you know. You're eating what's offered, given what you've already informed them about your... Because these days, you know, it's like... it's all vegetarian, but there's the vegans, and there's the gluten-free people, and there's the sugar-free people, and there's the paleo people, and then there's the... You know, so they do the best they can to make sure everyone has something to eat. You know, and then you leave that world. I remember leaving Burma, where, of course, every meal is offered. It's two meals a day. I was there for 3 months. And then Joseph and I left together, and we're sitting in Bangkok at this restaurant. And they hand us a menu, and it's like, what do you do with this? You know, like, it's culture shock. And... But you learn to not be so down on yourself, you know, for what you're feeling and to kind of hold it in perspective. Remember, equanimity means wisdom. So it's like the perspective of everything changes. This makes sense. There are causes for this. You know, this isn't just falling on my head in Bangkok. There are causes and conditions. I've lived a certain way for 3 months. This is going to be an adjustment, something like that. So we always want to bring wisdom into the situation. Anybody else? Weird what? Balance, okay. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so the comment was about the word balance itself. Last night I talked about some of the problems I had with the word. You know, for me, the word often seemed like dullness or mediocrity, like, oh, balance. And certainly, as you say, it's very much used in the culture, like work-life balance, and you have to spend a certain amount of time doing this, and you need a hobby, and, you know, and then there's the balance of that. It can be used in a lot of different ways, and I appreciate that it's an awkward word. It's just equanimity is more awkward. So it doesn't mean what it conventionally means. It might mean different things, you know, like realizing in loving kindness, for example, in that generation of compassion for ourselves and for others, it might mean the recognition that we can't leave ourselves out. It's not just about others. There's a kind of balance where we include ourselves as well as others. That doesn't also come automatically from most people in terms of our conditioning. We think of compassion as very externally directed and leaving ourselves out pretty much, and hence we have an epidemic of burnout. We think of there's a balance between compassion and wisdom, really, equanimity itself, because compassion has us move towards someone trying to help them, really caring. Wisdom reminds us it's not in my hands, you know. I was teaching via Skype or something for this friend of mine who was doing a yoga teacher training program. And we're talking about equanimity, and I said that one of the examples the Buddha used for equanimity was a parent whose child is now an adult. With his love and compassion and connection and caring, and there's also wisdom. Like, I can't make their choices for them. I can't decide what they're going to do for a livelihood. I can't choose their partner for them. Would that I could. You know, it's not like blank or something like that. But we can't. That's the reality. And so there's that understanding along with the love and the connection. So apparently there were a lot of people. I couldn't see many people in the room on my little screen. But there were a lot of people who had younger children. You know, there were kind of newer families. And so all these people were commenting on what I said by saying, it's not just adult children. You know, you can't decide, well, you're the creative one and you're the athletic one and you're the, you know, there's a kind of equanimity that comes from realizing I'm not in control. You know, this is what I can do and what I have to do. And this is what I can't do. You know, which is not resignation or apathy. It's really a kind of peace or balance. It's like, this is how things are. So what's the balance between having compassion for someone and realizing I can't fix it. It's not up to me. And what I was saying last night is that I don't think that realization is actually what has us pull back or withdraw. I think wanting to be in control and being frustrated more has us want to pull back and withdraw from some kind of helping situation. So there's lots of big kind of life balances that we look at, which is not the same as you need a hobby, you know. And we do it intuitively. We're not trying to figure it out, but we go through enough experiences in the practice that we kind of go through these different places. And then in a very immediate sense, there are many qualities we cultivate in any meditation that are about calm and quiet and peace. And there are many qualities that are about energy and interest and wakefulness, aliveness. And we also work to bring those in balance. Many of you have probably heard me tell or read somebody tell the story of when we began the Insight Meditation Society. And we were living in California, and I don't know. Somebody came through. We were running this little retreat center in a house somebody had given us to get us out of his house. He had a rental property down near Santa Cruz, so we moved there, and we opened it up as a retreat center. We had like 3 bedrooms or something like that. And somebody came through who was writing a book, and he said, "You should start a real retreat center. And I know just the people who can help you. They're all in Massachusetts." So he was right. So we went to the East Coast to look for a retreat center. And we looked up and down the East Coast. And finally, somebody directed us to the Catholic Archdiocese. In those days, the country was going through what we quaintly called the gas crisis. You know, where gas was getting expensive. These places were big, and like Catholic novitiates and places like that, hard to heat and so on. So we went to Worcester County. We got directed to Worcester County, this place in Barry, which was a novitiate at the time. And we were really torn about what to do. This is December of 1975. On the one hand, it seemed like the perfect place for a retreat center. It's really pretty. It's quiet. And on the other hand, it seemed so big. The place... well, we've built another building, so everyone has a single room. But even then, we could hold like 97 retreatants, you know, plus staff and offices and all that. So it just seemed enormous. And we hadn't been back from Asia all that long, and there weren't that many people who were coming to retreats. And we had no knowing how many people in this country would ever want to learn meditation or that form of meditation. And so we went to downtown Barry for lunch to try to figure it out. And Barry's a very classic New England town with the town green in the center of it. And in those days, there was a monument on the town green which had the Barry town motto on it, which is tranquil and alert. So we took a look at that and we said, okay, that's an omen. You know, any town that has a motto like tranquil and alert should have a meditation center in it. Because not only, remember, there's all the calming, quieting, tranquil side of things and all the alert, awake, energized side of things. Those are the qualities we talk about all the time, and we talk about bringing them into balance. And so we did it. It's still there. It's still flourishing. Mm. The monument is gone, but it's still the Barrytown motto, which I really like. We have, I think, 2 police cars, and it says, you know, tranquil and alert. And, these friends of mine got married there, and it's what's stamped on their wedding certificate. It said, tranquil and alert. But that's really also a kind of balance that we work with. I mean, I said it last night. Sometimes a teacher will just look at you and think, you're trying too hard. You need to relax. That's why I said, like, Upandita never said that to me. It was usually try harder. Okay. You know, but we work a lot with that. And it's also, it's a very different meaning of balance. So in that light, I'm going to introduce some walking meditation. And ask you to go out and do it this afternoon, unless it's raining or something, or too hot, we'll do walking with loving kindness. But for now, we'll do walking with mindfulness. And most of you will probably choose to go outside. Not all of you. Not all of you will choose to walk, and that's fine, as I said. You might just drink a cup of tea or something. And the basic principle is taking the kind of awareness into an activity, into life. So that means eyes open. And I'll use walking as the example. Eyes open, rather than trying to be aware of the breath, although some schools do teach that, being aware of the breath while walking. It wasn't the way I learned, so it's not the way I teach. Instead, we work with awareness of what's most predominant, which in this case is the feeling of your body moving. So feeling your feet against the ground, feeling your leg going up or going down, depends on the speed with which you're moving. If you're walking at home or in a very protected place, I don't know what to tell you about the parking lot here. I need someone from Sims to tell me or tell us. But if you, say, are walking inside or you're walking in your bedroom or maybe here or you're in some protected place, usually we experiment with different speeds. So it's just walking back and forth, maybe 15 feet, if you have that much space or however much space you have. And eyes open. If usually we begin at a pretty normal, brisk even pace. So what you can feel is just your feet touching the ground. So it's kind of like touch, 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 touch. And then if you want, you slow down somewhat. So you can feel your leg coming up and moving down, your other leg coming up and moving down. Now this isn't an anatomical exercise. You're not trying to figure out this muscle group's doing this, that muscle group's doing that. You're feeling heaviness, lightness, swaying. You're not trying to name those feelings, but that's what you're paying attention to. And it needs to be a very light awareness, right? Because if you hunker down, trying to block out everything around you, you'll barge into things and people, right? So even as you're aware of everything, you just have this light awareness. Like right now, find the most pronounced sensation in your body. And even as you listen, eyes open, and start thinking, where am I going to walk, or whatever you're thinking, you can just have this light awareness that you keep returning to that sensation. It's just like that. And then if you are in a very protected place, sometimes people like to slow down a lot. It looks incredibly bizarre. And we opened IMS, you know, I mean, we were young hippies. We didn't know anything. And it's this large brick building and has this sloping lawn that goes down to this little country road called Pleasant Street. And people were just doing this really slow walking on the front lawn, you know, and these cars would stop. Like, people would get out. Somebody always brings up Night of the Living Dead, you know. It's just like so weird. So I wouldn't suggest you do that down the streets of Seattle or, you know. Like I said, I'm not really... Is the parking lot okay? Yeah, maybe don't slow down all that much, you know.
But definitely, the parking lot is probably our, if we're going to walk back and forth outside, that's
kind of it. Okay. You know, I mean, slow down, but not that weird, okay? And again, that's optional. You know, you start at a normal pace. If you want, you slow down some, and then you slow down even more. Not so much you fall over, but so you can feel your leg going up, moving forward, placing down, shifting your weight, next leg up, forward, down, something like that. So we know you'll get distracted. You'll probably get distracted a lot. This is eyes open after all. And that's okay. You realize it. See if you can come back to the sensations of the movement. It's something that we do all the time. That's the point, is take an activity you do all the time and bring mindfulness to it. So if you're choosing not to walk, that's fine. You can have a cup of tea, wash the cup, you know, things like that. Eyes open is sort of the point. So you're finding that balance between awareness of the external world and mindfulness of the activity. Okay, so we're going to take about 25 minutes or so. I'm going to ask you to be silent. Maybe it will really take 30, because you probably want to go to the bathroom as well, and somebody will ring a bell after 25 minutes as a notice that we're about to try to head in, okay? So let's really use this as a time of practice. Okay, let's do another sitting, as you suspected. You're all sitting here meditating. Going back to what we did before, resting our attention on the feeling of the breath. But I'd like you to pay particular attention to how you speak to yourself when you realize your mind has wandered and what that feels like. You know, when you're really grumpy and angry at yourself, what does that feel like? And what's the energy that comes with that to begin again, or doesn't come with that to begin again? What it's like if you're more gentle and you recognize minds wander, you know, it's not just me or something. What does that feel like, and how does that affect your ability to just kind of come back and start over? Or shadings in between, just to observe, not to judge the judgment, for example, but just to observe, you know, this is what tends to happen, this is what it feels like, and the consequences of that, okay? So we'll sit together. So how are you doing? Do you need to break for lunch now? Anybody? Yes? Okay. We can. I tried to make the morning a little longer because the afternoon can be so hot and sleepy, but maybe we'll have, of course some people are cold, but maybe we'll have air conditioning on this afternoon in a way that everyone is happy, without exception. Or maybe not. So I'll just talk for a few minutes and then we can break for lunch. You're okay? Equanimity. Balance. And it's the balance in the mindfulness that allows us to learn and grow and understand our experience. So when we come back this afternoon, we can also talk about what you noticed, if you noticed something in terms of, was it different? You know, we tend to think of harshness and intense reaction as the best goad for learning and making progress or changing a habit, but is it really? And we tend to think of like balance or self-compassion or something like that as being too soft, so that it's more like laziness. But is it really? If we're looking at resilience, if we're looking at restoration, we're looking at repair, we're looking at being able to meet stress in a different way, what are the ingredients of that different way? If we're just going to notice more and be freaked out by everything we notice, it's not exactly healing path, you know. It's not exactly mindfulness. It's not, certainly not equanimity. So equanimity is very tied to wisdom. I think that's one of the key understandings, so that if you start to confuse it with apathy or not caring or withdrawing, you can remember that it's more like the perspective that comes from wisdom, and that doesn't hurt. You know, when we come back together, we'll talk a lot about equanimity's role in loving kindness or compassion, how we need equanimity, or loving kindness isn't really loving kindness anymore, compassion isn't really compassion anymore. And that when we use a word like compassion, whether we realize it or not, we are implying a certain kind of balance. The definition I used of compassion was the quivering or the trembling of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. That's sort of the empathy part. We'll talk about that too, the difference between empathy and compassion, which has to do with equanimity. The trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. So it's a movement toward that suffering situation to see if we can be of help. Notice that it's not a movement into to burn up ourselves. This is really mixing metaphors, but when we go down with the ship, no one is helped, right? So what do we need to move toward but not into? What do we need to have the feeling that we're bringing capacity, we're bringing strength to the situation, we're bringing presence to the situation. We're not just kind of like, whoa, that's really bad, you know? Let me go back to bed. Because it's way too much. You know, so equanimity is really implied in every use of the word compassion, or it really wouldn't be compassion. As I said last night, loving kindness and qualities like loving kindness and compassion are considered qualities of generosity. They're gift-giving, they're offering. They're offering our attention. They're offering our caring in a different way. And any kind of giving or generosity can be motivated by lots of different things, including maybe feeling we don't deserve to have anything, so we'll give it all away. Is that really generosity at that point? Or if I give this to you, I'll be in control of you. Is that really generosity at that point? And so for loving kindness to be a freely given gift, for compassion to be a freely given gift, it actually has a kind of hidden aspect, or often hidden aspect, of equanimity. That's what allows it to be truly generous. And so we'll talk about all that. We'll have fun. We've agreed that, I guess this room, we're going to try to keep in silence, and then I'm sure you're going to talk about that, and then, but you're welcome to come back after lunch, or you might take a walk. If you're walking in the neighborhood, walk quickly. As we say at IMS, when people come to do intensive retreat, before the teachers come in on opening night, usually we're lurking just outside. There's a walking room and some benches. So usually we're sitting on the benches waiting for all the announcements and stuff to be over. But I like to get there early enough to hear the manager of the course do some of the announcements, because my favorite part is when they say, if you run into one of our neighbors, act normal. You know, if somebody like says hello, don't like, you know, silent. Like, you can say hello back, you know, it's all right, or something like that. So act normal, really. If you take a walk, which would be great, act normal. If you stay here, of course, you can walk more slowly or whatever you'd like to do. If you want to come in here and sit, you know, if you have time, if you've eaten quickly enough, or if you want to come and lie down, you actually can do that if there's room. So we'll resume in an hour and a half from whenever we actually break. Okay.
All right, just a few announcements. I think because of how many people are here, we're not going to set up this area for lunch today. So what we have available is if you walk outside the doors to the left,